Welcome to Be Simply. This is she, and I want to thank you for joining us today. We have special guest Ian Baker, and he is here to share the wisdom from his book, Tibetan Yoga Principles and Practices. In addition, he will share some wisdom from his lifetime journey and exploration in and around these teachings. Without further ado, let's dive in with Ian.
Ian, I want to thank you for being here today. I'm super excited to have this discourse regarding your new book, Tibetan Yoga Principles and Practices. It's such a beautiful, comprehensive memoir of what was, but also an awakening for those that maybe have crossed paths with this at another point in time in their eternal life to awaken things within them. I'm curious for you, because it contains so much, where was your seed, you know, if we go through the whole book, where was the seed point that really spoke to you the most and kind of was the spiral out? Obviously, you have an organization to it, but was there one point within this book that really, that you're either passionate about or was like the driving force within this text?
Well, I'd say as a whole, the book is essentially, although it's not written in that way, it's a kind of exploration of what my life has been involved with over the last several decades, actually. So when I first went to Nepal in the 1970s, I became engaged by the practices and of Tibetan yoga. And it was a very experiential thing for me. And so actually this writing this book was essentially a retrospective by which I could actually begin to piece together both my own research, the images that I kind of collected and made over many years, and to put them in together into a coherent form. So in that sense, the book is, you used the word actually a memoir, and even though I purposely avoid the first person in the book, I mean, apart from, I think, the foreword. But it is, in that sense, a way of just trying to contextualize a lot of extraordinary material and to, as much as possible, to present it in a way that makes it accessible in a cross-cultural modern context, particularly in the sense of also exploring some of these practices in the context of what we now are beginning to understand about human physiology and the brain and the mind from neuroscience and other kind of scientific modalities, since that in a certain sense is the language that we bring to our experience today.
On that note of neuroscience, and can you share a little bit with the listeners, because it seems like for modern, we'll call modern society today, they need that, you know, once science has validated it, then they'll maybe like explore it. Yet, if you can share from just a practitioner state, even from yoga or Tibetan Buddhism, that how you get that feedback loop that doesn't really require the scientific data, because you're having this experiential awakening within, and then certain things open up. Like if we use, for example, even dream time, you touch on in this book. Can you share a little bit where you've had those moments, or where a practitioner has those moments where you can't refute what's happening within your practice? So you wouldn't necessarily need science to validate the awakening that's happening.
Mm-hmm. No, absolutely. I think in a certain sense that the science, where it's useful, is that it's actually bringing a new language and understanding to human experience. Because although obviously through spiritual work, yogic disciplines of various kinds, experiences arise that in a certain sense are self-evident, and yet obviously we come at those from our own cultural perspective and interpret them within the, you could say, the cultural paradigms in which they arise. So that, for example, certain kinds of transcendent, numinous, mystical experiences would be, you know, have been interpreted several hundred years ago in the Western world in a kind of Christian cosmology, and when they arise in the Himalayan world, they're you know, their visions of the Buddha or Shiva. But I think what the science begins to help us with is not, as you say, so much to validate these kinds of non-ordinary experiences, but actually to be able to understand them in a broader way, so that we, rather than defining them along in narrow kind of terms, we begin to look at them in larger ways, as being not just, you could say, religious phenomena, but actually aspects of human experience that are cross-cultural and that in a certain sense can be induced and trained in a variety of ways. So I think what ultimately the Tibetan yoga that I practices that I'm referring to, in that sense, that in a certain sense it's a misnomer to call them Tibetan, because in a certain sense they are experiences that we're capable of as human beings, that simply were developed and formulated more extensively in the Tibetan world, but that we have access to without any ultimate reference to that kind of, let's say, Buddhist paradigm in which the experiences are packaged, if you will, in the Indo-Tibetan tradition. So in that sense, it's, as you say, the science is both, it's not necessary to validate our experience, but it does help us to, in a certain sense, understand our experience in a broader and less culturally limiting and reductive way.
And from your perspective, with the science the way it is, like I teach in a couple of clinics, mental health and eating disorder clinics, and we do yoga, pranayama, and sound therapy, but they've been bringing in machines like to work on their brain. And how do you feel about the merging of, you know, working with the biological anatomy in addition with spiritual practice or yogic practice? Do you get a sense of kind of the cause and effect of that? Because sometimes we put the cart before the horse and we don't know really what we're tinkering with, you know, because if we set our own pace in our spiritual practice or yogic practice, we set that, you know, oh, do I want to go a little bit further, or I'm content right now with where I'm at. But if we start using machinery to simulate some of these things that they're actually been able to record through scientific means.
Well, I would say that in essentially all yogic methodologies, if you will, are interventionist in the sense that we are working with our own biopsychophysiology, neuroendocrinology, whatever it may be, whether it's using the breath, whether it's using focused attention, intensely physical practices. And in a certain sense, whether we confine ourselves to what you would say these traditional yogic technologies of the past, or whether we supplement them with modern external, let's say, support from technologies that may help to entrain brain waves or whatever it might be, I think I have personally not only no objection to that, I think it's actually, you know, really what, you know, as technological beings, and particularly in the 21st century, you know, we can bring so much more to the inner work if we open ourselves to working with really cutting edge technology. And as we know from technology, from outer technology at least, you know, it's sort of ongoingly updated. So, you know, for example, you know, an iPhone that we've had from 5 years, which seems state of the art, is no longer so. The same with our, you know, the computer through which I'm talking to you. So, this is this continual updating of technology that we are so familiar with in our everyday work lives, social media lives. There's no reason that should not apply to, in my mind, to our inner work as well. I mean, if we, you know, become sort of fundamentalist in our thinking and think that, oh, all these yogic technologies and meditative disciplines were sort of, as it were, set in stone, 2,000 years ago, and that what we're trying to do is to and that they're only authentic if they are of a certain vintage. I think this is a very limiting and reductive way of thinking, because, you know, if we applied that to medical science, for example, you know, we'd be stuck with medieval methods of surgery. So we
right.
certainly don't want to feel that we limit ourselves in the technology we bring to things. So briefly, in my mind, it's a very, very exciting phase in human history where we can find ways of, you could say, of hacking, to use the kind of contemporary term, or simply of accelerating certain kinds of yogic and meditative transformation, you know, that might take much longer if we maintained, if we limited ourselves, let's say, so-called traditional practices.
And isn't, when you're speaking, it kind of reminds me of cause and effect, in the sense that, like, our karmic loop, that things naturally arise collectively to help us with the effects of our past actions. You know, it's this moment. So whether it's medical technology, science, you know, worldwide practice of yoga, all these things come forward to assist us in keeping moving forward with our inner and outer evolution, would you say?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I yeah. Mm-hmm.
Tibet in general holds a really near and dear, I don't know, place in my heart. For me, there's been a lot of inner healing to do around some of the teachings and the practices, and then allowing it to reawaken and evolve for here and now. Can you share a little bit with the listeners? Because if we combine, let's say, outer technologies with inner technologies that we can practice, if you can share a little bit with the listeners about, from your own experience, about the reawakening, so where maybe your past self practiced in a certain way and then you meet it again and you're like, whoa, this is here again, how can I deepen the practice? Or you kind of, for me, it's felt sometimes like I pick up where I left off. If you can share a little bit about the value of that and maybe the retention as you move forward as an eternal being versus just Ian in your physical makeup in this lifetime.
Well, I think, you know, what I hear from what you're saying is this sense that we have of kind of innate affinities for certain practices, certain traditions. And, you know, like you mentioned, this certain kind of resonance with the Tibetan tradition, which obviously I've felt, you know, significantly in my life. And, you know, from the age of 18, when I went to Nepal the first time and just immediately felt that I was coming home. You know, it was this extraordinarily exotic world, but it was the first place I just felt that I was actually, the sense of deep belonging and resonance and affinity. And so in a certain sense, the practices that then became central to my life felt like things that I was just, again, it was a kind of homecoming kind of experience for me. And again, whether we attribute this to past life continuities or whether it's something even more mysterious in the way that our brains and minds are interwoven and interconnected, you know, is really a mystery. But, but the fact remains, I think, that that really, I think, really deep spiritual work comes certainly not from ever trying to kind of force oneself into something that feels anomalous or uncomfortable in any way. But I think there is this affinity that we look for. I mean, in a certain sense, it's like a relationship with, you know, an intimate relationship with anyone that we may feel that connection with. It's about chemistry. And there are certain practices we may feel chemistry with and other ones we don't. And it's the ones that we do that activate us. So I think this is really what, you know, for me has led to my deep fascination with, you know, the material in the Tibetan Buddhist world. But it doesn't mean that, you know, I don't have similar affinities and entanglements with other traditions as well.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you speak about the mind and, you know, what was one versus another's, or, you know, sometimes when I've been on quests, you know, I've contemplated, like, you know, just the singular to the whole. I mean, everyone's in feed into the collective mind, and what is the separation? You could spend a lot of time, or is there one? Mm-hmm. You know, for you and your journey as you continue to, be the steward of information that is really priceless, in the sense that we are in this day and age of being able to access, you know, I was talking with someone the other day that at this point in time, everyone has so much access to material that they can read instantly, books they can read instantly, where before we didn't have this, you know. So it is taking us on quite a bit of hyper speed for some interesting reason, you know, where we can digest so much, contemplate, and hopefully, you know, it continues to open. If you can share a little bit for you with that mind, even as if I keep dream time keeps popping up, when for the listener, if you can share a little bit about being the observer, and then, you know, how easy it potentially is to become a part of the set that you're observing, you know, or just being the distinct observer, whatever you're observing, whether it's a facet of your own mind that's ready to be liberated or transformed, or it's a way that you can assist others. If you can share a little bit about the opportunity where you can hold yourself in a place of observation that can give one clarity and opportunity, I guess, to serve self or others.
Mm-hmm. I think it's, as you say, to be in that space of clear seeing, if we think of it in that way, to observe, in other words, to be able to see something without feeling entangled in something to the degree to which no clarity exists and no space exists, gives this opportunity to work both with oneself and others in profound and transformative ways. And yet at the same time, I think, you know, in all spiritual work, as we know, at least from the Buddhist tradition, the sense of the observer also can be entrapment, because, you know, we think of sometimes observer versus participant, and it's sometimes to be an observer means that you're sort of surveying something from the outside rather than being deeply engaged with it. So and it probably comes from my own background, you know, in anthropology, but this idea of participant observation, which is the sort of fundamental, you could say, paradigm of anthropological fieldwork, even, you know, when I was in anthropology, more specifically than I am now, I always like to turn it around and talk about it to be an observant participant rather than a participant observer. Anyway, that means, in terms of spiritual field work, if you will, when we enter into the dream time and this dream world and the sense of which these porous boundaries become ever more evident between what we otherwise would think of as outer inner dimensions of reality, you know, we participate in that in the sense that we experience it. But it's obviously something we see, we observe. And sort of to bring this back, I think, as you were kind of implying, you know, how does this relate to our practice, both personally in our own personal evolution, as well as in our work with others, is, again, I just sort of use, if you will, a kind of spiritual anthropology, this idea of being the observant participant, so that, in other words, we don't identify in some limiting way with the phenomena that arise within our experience, which we can look at as being dreamlike, whether or not we're asleep or in REM sleep or awake, but as things that are our own mind, through habit, through conditioning, through the past and through our own predilections, creating a seemingly objective world that in fact, you know, isn't objective at all. It's just our own subjectivity that becomes mirrored in the lens of our own experience. So as a sort of coordinates for moving within that world, I mean, I really see it as, you know, we're moving obviously beyond the kind of conventional subject-object relationship of everyday life. And, you know, this doesn't mean that we're you know, that there's no objectivity, but it means that, you know, it's like two subjects in a way that are interacting. And I think the non-duality that we sort of look to in spiritual work is ultimately that union of subjectivities, rather than one being a subjective and one being objective. Obviously, it's a completely reciprocal dance. So I suppose, you know, what I'm getting at here is just, you know, what are the coordinates, if you will, of this kind of dreamtime reality, which in fact is not separate from the reality that we're always in. It's just a different dimension and a different level of engagement with the phenomenology of human experience.
Within dreamtime, and I like that you use, you know, subjective versus objective, because most people would say, you know, what their perception of what objective reality is based on their perception that everything has a dense form. So in the dream time, they might not, if they're lucid or they're aware in their dreams, they might not even say it's objective at all, versus they would lean towards more a subjective state. If you can share a little bit in the practices of dream time as the opportunity for doing that inner work to mm-hmm. assist from a dimension, you know, from being in a perceptual different state of being. But if you keep refining your practice, it feels just the same as the waking state.
Sure.
From my perspective.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you say, I mean, the book is modeled on six classical yogic practices which have been outlined from the 11th century in the Tibetan Buddhist world. And the fourth one of those is the practice of dream yoga, as it's called literally in Tibetan, Milam Naljor. But in a certain sense, it's what we would call today a kind of not just lucid dreaming, but a kind of bringing a meditative sensibility into lucid dream states. And what that involves are very specific techniques for learning how to sort of wake up within the rapid eye movement phase of sleep, so that we can begin to interact, change the narrative structure of our dreams that otherwise are things that we tend to experience passively. And sometimes they're wonderful, sometimes they're anxiety-ridden, sometimes they're just strange and unusual. But in the Tibetan yogic practice of working with dreams creatively, there's certain kind of meditative practices you do, breathing techniques, visualization techniques, and there are many, and they're outlined, some of them in the book, that you do so that, in a certain sense, you predispose yourself to wake up in the dream state. And, you know, you might do that, for example, by preparing your mind that if you see something anomalous that in your dream that you normally wouldn't be able to do in ordinary life, like fly, can be one of the triggers by which you say, okay, I'm dreaming. Now, that doesn't mean that you wake up and come out of the dream, but it just means that suddenly you have this range of possibilities at your disposal that we don't normally have in our normal waking state. We can't normally fly, walk through walls, you know, breathe underwater, but these are all things that we actually can do imaginatively in the dream state. So in the Tibetan yogic way of seeing this, you know, by actually cultivating those non-ordinary capacities in the dream state, and then we emerge out of them into our everyday waking life, we begin to just create a certain sense of flexibility and openness within our everyday life, where we begin to realize that things that might not have seemed possible suddenly become so. And it just, it's this idea of just trying to bring a certain fluidity and porousness into our experience of the phenomenal world, which again, in the Tibetan dream yoga practices, you begin to look at even the waking life as a dream. And the idea of doing that is to sort of recognize that it's something that can be interacted with, that it's not something fixed and unalterable, and that by seeing it as a dream, you can just suddenly change the narrative. So it's a certain sense of of magical thinking on the one hand, or of active imagination in the Jungian sense, but it's this idea of engaging experience creatively and imaginatively rather than passively. And in a certain sense, that's really the essence of the dream yoga practice in the Tibetan Buddhist view of things, is that, you know, we have more possibilities in that sense, strangely, when we're asleep and dreaming than we do in our own everyday waking state of consciousness. So it's this idea of breaking down those kind of conventional ways in which we look at one as being illusory and one as being real, and beginning to recognize that in a certain sense, common denominator of both is the human imagination. And that by working with the human imagination, rather than being in a certain sense the passive, you could say, observer of imaginative processes that are in any case taking place, we begin to develop more capacity and possibilities in our life.
Within that, when you talk about playing with the rewrites that we can do, if you can share on two things, the porous nature that happens and what's required for someone, because they might naturally, some of these things and just reading your book might activate within them, and sometimes you don't know exactly why what's happening, and it could be disorienting. So if you can share a little bit about managing porous nature in life, and then also on the other side, if you can share a little bit about the cause and effect wheel of the rewrites, where bringing in awareness when maybe you decide, if you're starting to realize that you can shift things, how you do it with non-grasping, from a grasping place, but maybe from your highest state of being.
Certainly. It's so I think in all of these practices, and again, it's not just limited to these six, let's say, classical Tibetan yogas that are essentially working with six different sort of energy centers or chakras within the body. Essentially, they're working from the bottom up, and I'll just mention them first because all these kind of come into play. So if we look at the six yogas in the Tibetan tradition as they were originally outlined in the 11th century, I mean, we work with the tummo, the yoga of inner fire. We play with fire, literally, both imaginatively and experientially, in order to transform our experience of ourselves and to bring a kind of renewed energy, vitality, and an awareness. And we use that to create a state of, you could say, intensified well-being. We would actually, you know, actually call in the Tibetan tradition, what we translate it as bliss. But bliss in the certain sense that it's, you have already transcended in the very experience of bliss any kind of grasping sensibility or mind, because desire is always, of course, characterized by wanting. Wanting in its original etymological meaning is something that's lacking, whereas a state of bliss is already a state of fulfillment, which there's nothing more to be desired. So, you know, from a Buddhist point of view, the actual experience of bliss is already to have solved, you could say, the problem that the Buddha proposed in the First Noble Truth, you know, that all existence is characterized by desire, dissatisfaction. The state of bliss actually overturns that. So this is what, you know, the first of these six yogas is about. It's about inducing, if you will, that state of bliss consciousness within the body by playing metaphorically with fire, in the sense of this inner fire. And this works then toward, and the fire actually brings about a state of illumination, as fire, of course, does. And all of these are essentially yogas of fire and light, because the next yoga is the clear light consciousness, the pure, unobstructed awareness that arises in the heart center as this fire, in a certain sense, is rising up and illuminating a dimension of human experience that is often obscured to us because we simply just don't pay attention to it, or we don't do those things that can bring it into greater focus and awareness. And that moves us then, you know, from these the yogas of the daytime, as it were, into the yogas of the night, which is the dream time, and then into practices that actually extend into end-of-life experience with the practices of Poa, the ejection of consciousness beyond the body, the exploration of these interdimensional realms between one life and another life, as it was understood in the Tibetan tradition. So you use the, you know, again, the word of this porousness of experience is really what this the porousness of these different states that we, in a certain, some of which we go through, you know, in our everyday 24-hour cycle of sleeping, dreaming, waking, breathing. All of these represent, in a certain sense, different states of consciousness that we can work with creatively and interactively. So again, all these yogas are really about just tools, technologies, to bring in a certain sense, to make those veils between these different levels of experience more porous, more diaphanous, to keep that metaphor, so that we begin to be able to dance between dimensions rather than feeling that we're on one side of a veil or another. We learn how to move between different states of being. And in that sense, we become masters of our own experience, not in some kind of controlling way, but just simply because we've learned how to play in a way more creatively. And in doing so, we are no longer sort of bound by the conventional kind of rules, which of course are only imaginary rules, that confine us to a single dimension. And in that sense, I think one of the operative words here is really play. We forget some. We tend to think of play as being something that children do, but it's probably even a more essential tool. I mean, it's actually, of course, how children learn to become adults, by playing at it. You know, we have to imagine the possibilities. We have to make believe, and by making believe these things, doesn't mean that we just end up in a world of magical thinking, but we actually begin to recognize that reality is malleable, and that we therefore, you know, are no longer sort of under the thrall of our projections and preoccupying thoughts, emotions, and kind of distorted perceptions.
Mm-hmm. You don't have to throw those 3-year-old tantrums.
Yeah, those can be actually. Well, I'm sure those 3-year-old tantrums. I think probably a lot can be learned from them.
Absolutely.
observing them even more so, and when the patience and actually just to watch, you know, in the beautiful unfolding of a child's existence, just that it's a sheer energy manifestation. And
yeah,
to begin
absolutely.
To sort of appreciate it on that level is also something that as adults, you know, we need to see that children are in their own, have their own technologies for state shifting, and certainly a tantrum can be a powerful one.
Absolutely. I always tell parents that those first 5 or 6 years, you can learn a lot about your child's soul, you know, and where maybe some of their inner work is if you observe them versus react to them.
Yes.
Within that, I like that the word play, it made me smile. There was 2 things I want to ask you in that regard, is that the use of laughter to actually kind of work with energy in a way that most people might think of it more, if someone says something funny, you're responding in laughter, but how in Tibetan principles and practices, and with something that naturally just arises, is this use of laughter that sometimes dissipates or like kind of like pushes the energy when it's rising up in a situation to help it, you know, reorganize or gain perspective with it. If you can share a little bit about that use.
Mm-hmm. Certainly. Well, I think, I mean, laughter, as we know, this idea of you know, of humor, if we want to look at it that way, is actually related to the original Greek concepts of medicine that involved, you know, let's say the 4 humors of the body. But if we look at it in our kind of more contemporary way in which we look at it, it's, you know, to have a sense of humor keeps us in good humor. In other words, it keeps us in a state of balance, and where we are learn to see things, you know, in a little bit, with a little bit of perspective, rather than feeling completely caught up in them. And of course, laughter in that sense is using the human voice in a way that completely transcends any kind of ordinary sense of language. Or we could actually rather say that laughter is this primordial language of the deepest levels of the subconscious mind, that in a way literally is an eruption of that brings us into a kind of a non-dual state. I mean, laughter does so many things. I mean, we also know from polyvagal theory now that laughter, like certain kinds of breathing along with muscular contractions, activates the vagus nerve and therefore kind of stimulates the parasympathetic response within the body that brings us into a state of deep relaxation and spaciousness. And we can obviously experience that after, you know, a wonderful bout of laughing. So we also know how spiritual traditions have used laughter, particularly in the Zen tradition in Japan. It was actually used as a method. The morning laugh was, started out with, some of these koanic utterances that we have in the Zen tradition that in a way are pre-rational, that were again designed to sort of cut through the linear conceptual mentation that prevents us from that kind of more illuminated, enlightened perception. But it also extended directly into laughter. And in a way, it was recognized it was something that could be induced, whether or not there was so-called cause for that laughter or not. It could be, and it would become infectious. And we also know that from, practices that are now done in India, where they have these sort of laughter labs, as they call them. So if you just hear somebody laughing for no reason, it becomes funny, and therefore it becomes infectious. And of course, in the Tibetan tradition, there were also the idea of laughter was used. We have records of it just simply in poetry and in phrases attributed to some of the great masters of the past. That the life itself sometimes can be so absurd that the only appropriate response is to just this great laughter, this laughter of the gods, as it were. Which just means that we cut through all of the kind of reified and perceptions that just keep us in taking things too seriously. So I would say that to me is really, sometimes spirituality can be taken far too seriously, and kind of in when it is, it can keep us in thrall to the very kinds of experience phenomena that we're actually needing to cut through. So I think this is why, a certain sense of play being brought to spiritual work is so important. And it's about experimentation, it's about exploration, it's about moving beyond the known into the unknown. And of course, the best model for that we have is when we look back on our childhood and remember how we could play games, and how those games were things that actually just brought us into a whole new sense of who we were and what we could be.
Beautifully said. If we can share about levity, or if you could share a little bit on death, yoga, and transcendent death. A lot of people mm-hmm. aren't comfortable with the concept of death in certain Buddhist traditions and yogic traditions. So that's part of the propensity if one is pulled to it, is to train yourself for death mm-hmm. in the sense of exiting kind of seamlessly. And if mm-hmm. you can share a little bit about the, how these all kind of lead up to prepare us for exiting this door and then entering into another space, perceptually, mm-hmm. maybe not. But if you can mm-hmm. share your relationship with it.
Again, as we know, looking, again, taking it from the context of the Buddhist tradition, which this book is, in a way, manifesting, the popular perception within the Buddhist tradition is, of course, that we have that one life leads to an ongoing, to another life, and that we pass through this kind of experiential phase between one life and the next, and that we need, that our spiritual work helps us to learn to negotiate. And these are the kind, this is the kind of end of life phenomena that is associated with death and dying, and which the Tibetan Buddhist tradition, of course, has a very highly developed kind of technology around. mean, one large part of that is this work that was translated, Bardo Tudel, that was translated into English in 1927 as the Tibetan Book of the Dead, but its actual meaning is the liberation on hearing at the moment of death. And so what it involved was actually to have those who were initiated into the practice, in a sense, being read to at the time that they were making this transition, and in a certain sense being encouraged to not identify with the kinds of phenomenological apparitional appearances that arise as the sense organs are beginning to lose their boundaries. And of course we know from experience of now of near-death experiences and out-of-body experiences, some of that phenomena. And we also see that a lot of that phenomena is associated with very transcendent and positive phenomena. So that, you know, for example, those who have had these near-death experiences, you know, do come back. And you know, whether we have books like, you know, Heaven is Real, which of course are just projections because these people haven't died and come back. I mean, you can't die and come back. You can have a near-death experience that can be extremely noetic, in the sense that it can be filled with light, illumination, and a feeling that you have completely have a separate existence from the human body. But you know, unless the brain and flatlining isn't enough, it just, you know, as long as there's a brain, the mind is still being moderated through it. And so it's a great mystery as to, you know, where does the mind, what happens to the mind, if anything, with the complete dissolution of the human body. That remains the great mystery. But I think what's important in all of these experiences, whether we look at it from the traditional descriptions in the Eastern yogic traditions, or from contemporary parapsychological research into near-death experiences, is that the overwhelming evidence is that, and there's actually this research is going on very much now in Switzerland, that where they describe that the state of dying is to go into a state of non-duality, and that associated with that is a state of bliss. And it's only if we hold on to a kind of conventional coordinates of everyday mind and thinking that we can block that experience. So in a certain sense, I think, you know, if we look at what is the common denominator within all of these technologies for learning how to transition into either end-of-life experiences or into kind of liminal states and, you know, however they might arise, it's learning how to let go. Not how learning to let go of life and love and all of the things that we think, you know, that are so wonderful, but just learning to let go as a simple technology of cutting through, if you will, cutting through the obstacles that we create for ourselves that block that experience of a larger reality that's beyond our mind as we have become habituated to think of it. So it's a way of letting go of thinking, letting go of our kind of emotions, which are simply the movements of the mind as we, again, tend to become connected to. And moving in to and embracing that larger reality that arises. And I think that really is the, you know, and the training for that, of course, in the Tibetan tradition is to simulate the experience of death, which of course is viewed ultimately in the Tibetan tradition as this incredibly noetic, blissful, illuminated reality, which is the bardo, if one can enter into that state without clinging towards the conventional linear coordinates of everyday experience, but rather open to the pure luminosity that is there always as the substratum of our minds and our bodies and our existence. I mean, we are light. We know that, you know, matter is energy and energy is photons, and photons is illumination. So this photonic reality of light is really, you know, what we, in a certain sense, have come from, and it's, you know, it's where we're going. And in the meantime, we're having this incredible adventure of inhabiting these human bodies, or these human bodies inhabiting our minds, however we want to look at it. playing with that in fundamental dynamic, you know, of whether the mind is in the body or the body is in the mind. I mean, it's really there. You look at it suddenly from both sides at once and could be very freeing. And I think that's really probably one of the best kind of ways of being able to look at end of life experiences for ourselves and to help others to learn to sort of just to let go of our limited ways of seeing at a time when obviously our sensory apparatuses are shifting and a new reality begins to unfold.
So much exciting opportunity from my vantage in that moment. but yep. Not everyone celebrates my enthusiasm.
No, we don't celebrate. I suppose it's not something to celebrate, but it's something to, when that moment comes, and I guess that's really what the Tibetan tradition is telling us, is that we prepare for it simply by learning to in a way, be comfortable with the fact that, you know, we as human beings, as living beings, you know, the very nature of life and existence is defined by the fact that it doesn't last. And
right.
The sense of impermanence, the sense of transience, is something that, we, in a certain sense, we have to recognize as a reality and to some degree become comfortable with.
Right.
So that we don't, live in our lives in a state of denial, but rather in a state of just deep gratitude and appreciation for the vitality, health, and life and existence that we can have, hopefully, as long as we want it.
Absolutely. Yeah, and I guess it's for me more of the internal celebration of that. Like, as a child, I've been very fascinated with knowing preparing and knowing before the exit point. Because in a lot of, in a monastic, if you're in deep meditation daily in your practices, you will feel your gateway rise up, which is rather curious is how aware in these practices, and maybe we can close out on this point because I know I'm like going over almost, is that if you can share a little, just to close out on that concept of how you start to feel into the quantum field, for lack of better syntax, as kind of a map where you see these pinpoints like, oh, that's going to happen here, that's going to happen here, not so much linear but more spiral in nature. If you can share a little bit about that and how that does help you, from my perspective, prepare and be present, even maybe more present than you normally would if it snuck up on you.
No, I think, actually exactly as you describe, and it kind of goes back to where we started with full circle, with this idea of, in a certain sense, that the experiential states that we're describing are things that arise from our inner work. They're not things that we have to subscribe to because they're described in scientific literature, for example. So whether it's through meditation, deep states of immersive states of yoga, we open to a, as you call it, a quantum field, in a certain sense, a field of possibility that where we've entered into a kind of spiral logic as opposed to a linear progression. What the poet Navalis referred to as moon grammar, in a certain sense that there's this sort of sense of immersive, interpenetrating, interconnected worlds. And that within that, as you also mentioned, we're seeing kind of different points of possibility. We're seeing kind of visionary states that can begin to seem that they are that they anticipate or prefigure events that are going to happen. They may be imaginative projections. They may be phenomena from a level of experience that is normally veiled to us simply because we don't put ourselves in the way of such experiences. But I think that's really, from your work and from, all of what we're describing, this is the extraordinary invitation that all of this kind of inner work, whether it's from the Tibetan tradition, Western tradition, opens us to, is to just to begin playing with another dimension of human possibility, which we have access to through different forms of contemplative work, meditation, contemplative prayer, whatever it might be, that suddenly we are freed from the kind of just linear progression which our lives just sometimes seem to progress in a rather dreary and overly predictable or let's say less than optimal way. And suddenly there is this, as you call it, you know, a quantum possibilities that things are coming out of left field or right field, from top and bottom. And it's that dimension that we learn to let go into, or we learn to embrace, because really it amounts to the same thing. And when we do that, it's just we realize that our life, it becomes renewed in that process, and that everything we might have thought we are when we identify only with our current thoughts and emotions is really just a shell of this incredible being of light that we all are and that we all share, because, you know, we're all within that photonic dimension, if you will. And I think this is really a very exciting thing about, you know, what all these practices are leading us to. And it's about really, I mean, if there was one key to it all, it's just really trying to learn to let go of the fear, the anxiety that we have in trying to, let's say, define our lives in a way by solidifying them, as opposed to just opening them up to sheer possibility. I think that it's really that. You could say perceptual and experiential shift that just makes life so much more exciting and worth living, is when we can just let go of that fear that keeps us, in some sense, makes us our own slaves to our own limits.
Lean into the possible.
Absolutely.
Well, Ian, I've exceeded our time. I could talk to you for days. I run one to just say thank you from the bottom of my heart, and all those that you touch through your writing, and all those that you help really transmute and articulate some complex concepts into a format where people can digest, and then they, like I said, they're little seeds that wake people up that they have no idea, You're a beautiful, magical being and scribe, so I appreciate you. We will put all your links. What's the best website for the listeners to connect to your work, and we'll share your books and different things that you've done?
Well, I have a kind of dormant website that I just simply haven't had time to deal with, which is actually just www.ianbaker.com, and I will resurrect it at some point. If people do go to it, it simply has my email address on it, a couple images, I think, and so people can reach me through ian@ianbaker.com or the ianbaker108@gmail.com, either way. And as I said, because of this incredible immersion that I have right now in a couple different writing projects, I just haven't dealt with the website, but it is something that in the coming months I will certainly be looking at and resurrecting. And because once I kind of emerge from this writing phase, there will be certain events and travel seminars, experiences, and things like that across the world that I'll be engaged with again, and all of that will be up on the website. But in the meantime, if people are particularly interested, they can just contact me by email. I think that's the best.
Beautiful. Well, thank you. I like I said, I really appreciate you taking the time. So
my pleasure.
You enjoy the rest of your evening over yonder.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
We'll keep connected. We'll see when you make it stateside to teach over here. It would be great to learn from you.
Very good, Susan. Again, thank you for inviting me onto your program, and for being able to share some thoughts on the nature of things. Mm-hmm. I look forward to in touch.
Yeah.
All thank
you.
Now. Thank
okay,
you.
Take care.
Well, once again, I want to thank Ian Baker for being here today. You can connect to his work below, and we'll update the links as he puts forth his calendar in 2020, where he'll be around the world. Until next time, this is She, signing out with a full heart, a soft gaze, a deep bow, and a namaste. Be simply.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered Chumbacasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to Chumbacasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. Chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.